And I think that, yeah, different people have different kind of policies on this. I need to work mine out for sure. Part of the reason why I do like video all the time is because basically, all right, the picture's all, but the video at least is there, right? So you can kind of see the gray is starting to happen and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, okay, we're live, everybody. Welcome to Founders Focus. We are back. Folks, I say this now every time, but it is actually true. This is my favorite thing to do every week because I'm learning so much from the conversations I have with people who are so upset at the problems in recruiting that they thought it was a good idea to set up a company to try and do something about it. I think these are unusual people. I think they've gone to make an unusual decision, and I think we can learn a lot from their journey and the path that they've made. So it's great to be back with you today on Founders Focus. And I'm delighted to welcome onto the show Virgil Ranga, CEO of Figures. Virgil, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you for having me. I'm very flattered and very happy to be here.
Great to see you, dude. I need to start straight away by saying, firstly, as a busy CEO, what kind of like things did you have to cancel in order to appear on Founders Focus today?
No, actually nothing. It was in my calendar for long enough that it was the most important part of my day. Perfect. And despite it being a relatively busy day, as you might have seen or you might discuss as we announce an acquisition, I didn't cancel anything. It was the center of my day was talking with you, Hank.
You're the second French dude that said this. So I wonder whether the French are particularly well organized on calendar, which kind of may go against a little of the stereotype. I don't know. But it seems to be, hey, I've got two data points to say that's the case. So I'm prepared to go with that view. Well, great to have you on in any case, Virgil. Tell us about the news. You mentioned there was something going on. I mean, maybe some people don't know about that. What has happened recently that's been like exciting for you guys?
We just announced that we acquired a UK company called Payspective, which is basically doing the same that we do as Figures, right? So we are doing compensation benchmarking for now, and we have a product for companies, startups, and scale-ups to benchmark their compensation with the rest of the market. And we just acquired a UK company that was doing the same, which means we have an extra 115 clients of today and a significant data set in the UK, meaning we have valuable compensation data in the UK and we can actually start helping out companies over there.
Wow, amazing. So that's quite an aggressive move, if you don't mind me to say, in the early stages of your business. So great to do the acquisition. Let's talk about it. As a CEO, as a new CEO of a business, this is one of the big decisions you got to make, like buy or build, right? So how did you come to the early idea that, you know what, I'm going to buy this company? What is the thought process in your mind to think, here is something we want to get? What are the steps to get there? This is, I think, most people won't have any clue on. Let's start the conversation on that point.
Yeah, well, which is funny. Like, if you ask me one point, like 2 years ago, whether I'll be, first of all, talking with you, and second of all, like talking about potential acquisition, I think I would have laughed in your face. But how did you get to this? Is like, in our business, in order to provide value to our clients, right, we need to have a great product, which I think we do, thanks to my co-founder, Bastien, and a good enough data set, right, to provide value to our clients. But we need reliable data, and we've chosen the option not to rely on external third-party data or scraping of websites like some people do. We collect data from our clients, we validate it with them, so we want it to be very reliable. So when you launch in a new country, right, you don't have any data. So how do you collect the data? You start gaining your way slowly, offering Figures for free. Some clients, so it takes some time. So acquisition was already as an option to accelerate, like acquire someone who has client base, has some data, and can help you out immediately. And so we met Payspective as part of discussing with our competitors, right, which is an interesting discussion as well. I always thought that you never chatted. Like, I should never talk to any of our competitors. But it turns out, discussing with some of my advisor and mentors says, no, this is what you do all the time. You just get to know them, get a feel for them, and so on. Talking to one of them, they're like, okay, we have data in the UK. We don't have a very strong product as of today. We're building one. You have data outside of the UK and a good product. It seemed like a match, and we took it from there and pushed the discussion a bit further. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, and good to kind of have that awareness that, you know, interacting with competition or people who, you know, previously we might kind of intuitively think you've got to keep away from the business, but but typically this happens less than you imagine. I think people outside of startup or are starting up at the first time often think that it's like you have to be super defensive, everything NDA, everything secret. Actually, no, you know, everything's like pretty open. We're just talking about trying to solve these problems. And, you know, we were all pushing kind of in the same direction. And at some point, of course, there'll be some jostling or whatnot. But generally speaking, I rarely see examples of people that are just like inherently hostile to their competition. You know, that's rare. And oftentimes there's a reputational damage if you do that. So, it's something people should know. If you start a business, talk to your competitors. Yeah. Rule number one of entrepreneurship. Okay, Vishal, let's go back in time when you started the business. You are, I think, one of the rare people that have gone sort of through the journey as a HR person, as a, you know, comp and ben specialist, I think at the beginning, and all of this is kind of the most anti entrepreneur career path possible, right? If you don't, and I mean due respect to everyone in HR, where a lot of people follow brain food are in HR, I mean it fully respectfully, but because it is a very compliance driven, very structured, typically you're working big company, all that type of stuff, like this doesn't seem to be the place where entrepreneurship emerges. So for you, why did it happen, Vigil? Like, well, what made you think, you know what, screw it, I'm going to do this crazy thing? What was the moment?
It's an amazing question, right? So as you said, I've done like 10 years of HR, starting in compensation benefit and in generalist HR role in large company, then 3 years at Criteo, which was, I don't know, mid-sized company, like 2,000-3,000 employees, HR director. Then I moved to HR VP of people operation in a startup. Where, and even then, I actually always said all my life, I'll never create a company, right? I'm an HR person at heart. I love supporting great leaders, but I don't think I'll be able to lead a company one day. I don't think I'll be able to create anything from scratch. I mean, that was not for me, right? But I think there's two things that happened is during my last, my last experience as an HR, as I said, in a HR director for a post-series A startup. First, there was like entrepreneurs everywhere. Right, like pretty much we had a bunch of people who created their own company and came, or a bunch of people who were in this company, Comet at the time, has a launching pad for their own startup, which is something that we accepted. Like we actually love having people being like, I'd love to join the company. I'll do 2-3 years before starting my company. And so you get exposed to those kind of people and you get exposed to entrepreneurs, people who've done it, and you start realizing, well, maybe it's something, you know, that doesn't seem as inconceivable for you, for me to do, to actually create a company. So I think it's the environment, like being in this environment actually changed my mindset. I was 100% sure I would never be in this position 2 years, like 3-4 years ago. But going through that actually changed my perspective. And then the second thing is finding a pain point, something that drove me, which was when I was over there, I had no reliable compensation data. Every time I wanted to create my compensation strategy, my salary grid, I was like, which data should I use? There's actually none. And it drove me actually insane. And so I had, I think, something that, I had this passion, like the pain I wanted to fix, which is a pain I faced as an HR director. And I had the chance of being in an environment where I could see, well, I guess this is doable. Like creating your own company is doable.
Yeah, amazing. Two great points there. Firstly, I want to sit on that a little bit. Just the environment that you're in gave you the example so it basically closed the distance between it becoming a fantasy and something that was real. And now I'm kind of going back in some of the conversations I've had. The only people that I think were always going to be entrepreneurs in the Founders Focus series, they had parents that were still entrepreneurs. So that was their exposure. So here's the thing with entrepreneurship, folks. Lesson number two, it's contagious. It is really, really good to surround yourself with people that have different ambitions, different viewpoints, different whatever, because it might give you just that little bit of inspiration or a little bit of awareness, a little bit of confidence, whatever it might be, to go ahead and try something yourself. How many of us, for instance, have entrepreneurial potential, but actually never went there because we just didn't have the person in front of us to do that? I think most of us, to be honest, we needed to be in the milieu to do it. So that's a really, was there any particular one individual that you thought, you know what, if he can do it, I can do it.
It does sound quite bad, like in the sense of when you put it like, who's the one individual where like, he can do it? I can do it. No, I don't think. In fact, it's the other way around because my CEO at Comet was Charles Thomas, and he's the guy. He's the kind of person like Nicolas, one of my advisors, that I think are born to be entrepreneurs. Like I can't even imagine them doing anything else than creating and leading companies. And those kind of people actually don't help you become entrepreneur, because when I meet those kind of people, when I met my previous CEO, I was like, I can't do what he does. Like,
yeah, I'm not intimidating.
We don't have the same DNA. We're not even part of the same species, right? But he's kept on meeting other ones, people who failed, people who succeeded, talking with them. You're like, yeah, it is a journey. It is an adventure. It is a lot of time and effort, but it's not out of the ordinary, right? It's more not meeting one person, but meeting a multitude of persons that made me realize, well, I think it's doable.
Yeah, it's contagious. And this is part of the reason why, you know, being in surrounded by technology innovation, surrounded by companies and people trying new things is really valuable. I'd be interested to know whether this is a persistent state, because if we move to, let's say, a remote environment, remote first environment, for instance, will that actually damage the opportunity for new entrepreneurs to be born, because we're going to be less exposed, aren't we? Like most remote conversations we have are already pre-planned. So we already have an agenda. There are already people maybe we know. Oftentimes we need to simply be like serendipitously in a situation and you bump into somebody in the shop or something and you find out what they're doing and all this kind of stuff. Does remote have a dampening effect on future entrepreneurship, Virgil?
I think it's a good question. I think maybe it will kill some of the serendipity of meeting new people or randomly and so on. I agree with you on this point. And so it is tied to the conversation of like how remote can impact creativity in a business. Like I've had, and it's an HR discussion that I think you've had, and that's a very interesting one. But on the other hand, I think the whole accessibility of remote work, I mean, I created my company, lost in Saint-Malo in Brittany in France, and I didn't meet anyone. I don't think I've met physically my first 80 clients or so. So I was able to do it you can do it from anywhere in the world. Like you can start a business from anywhere in the world. So I think in the creation process, it might be true that this remote world like might actually kill some potential of business creation. But I think in terms of getting it done, I'd say it's the opposite. So yeah.
There's a balance, right? So I think maybe the inspiration goes down a little bit. So you have to be a little bit more self-motivated, but the barrier to entry is lower. So it's easier to do because you can acquire customers, you can acquire, you know, whatever you can, employees, you can do all of that more remotely. So perhaps it'll balance out. Maybe who knows, overall net-wise, it will be a plus, but worth thinking about. Okay, let's talk about the pain point. There wasn't any compensation data. This might actually be a good time to talk a little bit about figures. Give us the two sentences on what this is and why people should care about it.
Basically, we're for a product for decision makers in startup and scale-up to benchmark their current compensation with those from the rest of the market and their direct competitor.
Yeah, right, and so the way how do you get the data? I assume it's because if I want to use it, I need to give up my salary data for the staff anonymously, right? Yep.
Exactly. Cool. That's the case.
That's it. Yeah. Perfect. Very, very good. Very, very simple model, man. And by the way, this is a good example of the value of anonymization and aggregation, because it basically means you can absolutely see benchmarking on it. Isn't this a concern for some companies that maybe don't have a robust compensation scheme? Like some companies are ran very skinny, let's say, in the sense that, you know what, they can't necessarily feel they can afford to compete with these companies, etc. Maybe we want to try and always negotiate this best deal we can. Like, what do you say about those companies or that attitude? Do you think that's like a legacy position or an old traditional view? Or do you still think it's persistent and something we need to educate the market on?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, right? There's still actually people with that kind of view and that kind of strategy, I'd say. And it's still relevant for them because they can get access to market data. Then basically they do whatever they want with it. Either they use it to maximize negotiation or they use it to actually bump up salaries in some areas, but at least they know, right? It's very different than flying blind. But we can't manage. I have a core belief that what you describe is not the way I think companies should definitely drive their compensation strategy. But, and this is a frustrating thing with figures, is we can only give them the best data possible, the best analysis possible. We can nudge them a little bit towards transparency, fairness, removing negotiation out of the play because this creates unfairness. But at the end of the day, we're just, they're responsible of the decision they make, right?
Yeah, yeah, I totally get it. And I love the positioning there as well. Like, you can't advocate particularly, like, too obviously on a particular position, because fundamentally you're an information provider and an intelligence tool. So that's what they want. You know, and if you choose to ignore the data or you choose to continue a strategy that is, you know, away from the rest of the market, then that's your business, then you're okay to do that. So very, very interesting indeed. Okay, so you've been doing this for how long now? 2 years, Virgil? 3 years?
A bit less, October 2020, so a bit over a year and a half, I'd say.
Okay, so a year and a half. Can you tell me, like, of this period of time, if you don't mind me to ask, like, what has been your, like, toughest decision that you've made in that period of time?
The hardest one, like, the key decision there during that period? I think there's been two types of, I think there's been two critical decisions, right? So very early on, in fact, for the story, I started by myself. At the beginning, there was no product. I just asked companies for their compensation data as Google Sheets, aggregated it, gave them back a Google Sheets with aggregated
Perfect.
Data.
I love right? it, yeah.
And it was, didn't take me that much time and so on. So then I met Bastien. I knew Bastien, my co-founder from the past, and I was like, I think there's a product to make out of it, right? There's a limitation spreadsheet. I think there's a product to make out of it. So I started building a product. There was two, I think, key decisions we had to make. At one point, it was like, okay, do we want to remain a bootstrapped, low headcount type of company and just do our thing at our pace and so on? Or do we want to go more aggressive, like raise funds, accelerate, hire people, go internationally and so on? I think there's two reasons why we actually choose option number two, right? Meanwhile, it was not our preferred option at the beginning. One was a very personal decision that we wanted to leave that experience. We're like, okay, maybe it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to go through that growth, growing a business, expanding internationally, acquiring business, raising funds. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity to know that from an experience perspective. And maybe it's one we want to know. We can always go back and find an opportunity to have a small business. We might never have an opportunity to create a bigger one. So this was the first one. The second one was more of a business decision, is that due to the nature of what we do, it's most of the winner takes all or winner takes most market, in the sense that might be consolidation. And if we were, it's either you go big or go home. There's a chance that if we remain too small, we would get eaten alive by any new competitor that would come. Meanwhile, there was none at the time. Now there's some popping up. And if you're too small, you might die later on. So this was the first decision, to go towards a more aggressive expansion, VC funded trajectory.
I love the emergence of the idea, Virgil. So this is basically your problem you had. You're operating as a HR director or something. You had this issue. Your reaction to that was to say, screw it. I'm just going to ask these companies to provide the comp data, and I'll just promise them, hey, listen, give me the data and I'll share everything I've got with you once we've inputted it in. And then suddenly this became a Google spreadsheet, I guess, that companies are using, right? So how many companies did you get onto the spreadsheet before figures became a thing?
I think we got to 50 companies on the spreadsheet, maybe more than that. In fact, we switched the product around 50 to 60 companies using it. It was just a spreadsheet I kept on adding. And, you know, I kept on adding tabs because, like, I had this consolidated data for CTOs, but a CTO of a 20-person company was different than a 400-person company. So I created a tab to split categories of CTOs per headcount, per funding. At some point, this is where I was like, why am I doing this in a spreadsheet when a product could do all that, right? All the filtering, all the tinkering around, and so on.
Tell me the spreadsheet still exists in some form, man, because I think that would be a very cool artifact in the history of figures, right? Let's imagine 2 years down the line, 5 years down the line, figures are like your multi-billion dollar business, whatever, you still have the spreadsheet somewhere. Like,
well, you're 100% right. So we have this history page on Notion where we keep track of this thing. We keep track of the first document we signed with my co-founders when at the time I agreed to give him some of the revenue. It was not even a share agreement. We keep all of that quite locked in into our history page and your history books. Yeah.
That's great. Great stuff. And fantastic that this started in a very lo-fi way. I think that's a classic way to do a startup, isn't it? Like, try and fix it without too much tech. because you need to figure out whether there's value there. And the fact you've kind of got to 50 customers or 50 users that are voluntarily prepared to put their data in, I think is a very good sign there's market value there. So it's a really good way of low-cost market-proofing your product. Too many people I see go away and spend time on marketing, spend time on product polish, spend time on like hiring engineers or even outsourcing development, all of this stuff before there's even a single interaction with a customer. And you think, you know what, you're building something, you better have a, it's like throwing a dart to a very, to the bullseye and hoping that it hits and you're from, you know, very far away. Very, very hard thing to try and achieve. So great example for basically low cost experimentation, but real experimentation with the marketplace. Fantastic stuff. Okay. And I love the idea as well, Virgil, that you wanted to experience the journey, right? So this was not entirely strategic, even though the strategy aligned, but it was also about, hey, listen, I've spent being a corporate guy, successful at the senior level, HRD or whatnot. You know, this is a kind of apex position in the function, really. But you want to experience the journey of actually running this company in this startup thing. Again, a great lesson to learn from for entrepreneurs. You've got to enjoy the journey. You've got to also, it's part of your decision making. Do the stuff that's going to help you grow as a person. That's going to make you a better CEO. Okay, on to that point, Virgil, you're new to the idea of being a CEO. How is this different from being a C-level sort of a departmental head in a bigger business? What are the differences in your view?
Well, it's a very good question. In fact, you mentioned two things which are, I think, quite different in the way you phrase that question. Like department head versus C-level. And I think, I'm not sure I would have, environment aside, right? We discussed about previously, I'm not sure I would have been able to create figures if I, after my role at Criteo, where I was HR director for the tech function, so it was 800 employees, right? So I was HR director of a fairly large chunk of the business, but I was not a C-level. And the key difference there was that I was in charge of a whole department. I had a team at some point between recruiting and when I managed a recruitment team, it was like 15, 20 person, just the HR team, I think it was like 5 or 6. But I was not a C-level and I didn't sit down in executive meeting, in board meeting and so on, which I did once I moved to my next company in Comet. And this is a big difference. Why is it a big difference? Because when I moved to Comet, I started being exposed to business decision, business discussion, and so on. I started being exposed to, should we change our pricing? Should we expand internationally or not? Should we change the structure of our organization? What's our marketing strategy? What's our operational structure to onboard clients? Where are the key KPIs we're measuring? Basically, when I moved to Comet, my role became, I think, 90% or 80% HR director, similar to what I was in a different environment in the past. But 10 to 20% of my role became, I was a C-level of a company involved into company, like to important company discussions. And this was super key because this prepared me to some of the things I've been doing since. This prepared me to start thinking about sales cycle, high touch versus no touch, conversion rate, funnel, marketing strategy, finance, expansion discussion. And without that step as a C-level of a company where I was involved into those discussions, I think my role today and my role early on would have been much, much, much harder. And in fact, I'm not sure I would have been able to do much of the things that I do.
Really, really important distinction there. And that distinction between head of and C-level is essentially your kind of you're moving beyond the function of your department and thinking as there's a mini team of C-level folks that all of whom have moved beyond their function and all of whom are thinking about the business as a wider unit of analysis. And everyone is involved in those decisions and inputting in sales, marketing, whatever it is. It's not the final decision, maybe the CEO and the head of the department to implement, but everyone inputs into this and gives their opinion from their own perspective. So really important insight in all of this. In all of those activities then, as a C-level person now, what are the CEO things that you enjoy to do, Virgil, and what are the things that you don't like to do in your new role now?
I'll start with the things I don't like to do, right? I hate all the paperwork, the administrative side of things, all the accounting and so on, right? And having just drives me absolutely nuts. I'd say, and it's needed, like especially when you start early on. And I mean, still today, the pain changes, but still remain present. Like it used to be just, how do I create my company? How do I file my, I don't know, taxes and so on? It was a nightmare. And now it's just at a much bigger scale. Our previous accounting firm messed up the books for the last year. So it's been in a rush for the past months trying to reconcile all these parts. Honestly, yeah, all this administrative, accounting, financial part of things as well, it's like corporate decisions, all the paperwork that's aligned with that. I mean, when you raise funds, there's a fundraising part, and then there's a just signing up hundreds and hundreds of documents and pages that I didn't even read, to be honest, because I think my sanity relied on me not reading those documents. So I'm not sure what I've signed up to. I actually don't know what I've signed. The last 80% of the document I've signed, and I actually don't know what's on it. Probably, maybe a bad call. I'm not giving out advices to people, right? I'm just saying my personal experience, but I actually, that keeps me sane. On the what I love doing, but man, I mean, it ties to my point about the whole experience, and I kept hammering about this to the team at our last offsite. For me, it's been really moved to more focusing on the journey rather than the destination, and I'm living my best life. I love building a product. I think that's been a number one thing for me, thinking about what we can deliver, thinking of the value we're bringing to our clients and so on. So building a product, sitting down with the tech team, my co-founder, and so on, to be like, I think we should do that, should we go toward that, exchanging about that with our clients to see what they think. It's incredibly, it gives me a ton of energy. I think I love building. It's tough at time, but I like building a company. I like the building a company, a culture, making those decisions, and having people enjoy your product. In fact, one of the best moments I've had is when we hired our first sales, Chloe, and I heard her selling figures to clients and prospects when it was not me doing it. I mean, it was incredible feeling when you hear people, like, it's always this analogy with a baby, like talking about figures a different way than you do, but with some passion, with some real energy and so on, I think was a key moment. And I don't know, I love confronting new problems every day, finding solutions to new problems, working on product, working with people, building a team. I mean, it's just acquiring a company. So in fact, we were discussing this, my co-founder, like going through negotiation of an acquisition. So we were in a co-working space, discussing with the company about the terms, then moving away, if it's okay, let's split room, going back with counter. I mean, this whole thing was incredibly stressful, tough, but after we've done it, like, it's such a bliss. I feel blessed to have lived through those moments, fundraising, acquisition, building a team, first hires, 10th hire, 15th hire, and so on. I mean, I don't know, it's a blast.
Yeah, that entire journey, I think that the decision you make, I think at some point to enjoy the journey, or at least be aware of it and be sort of conscious of all of that experience, really helped, I guess, make those moments more obvious to you. You know, a lot of people might look back on it, you know, 10 years past or in the future, they'll look back at it and think, oh, that was great. But you're kind of living it now, which is fantastic. That's exactly how it should be. And you're taking the time to breathe it in.
And you know what, hang on this one, because in fact, your question, it makes me think that you asked the question of the cutoff decision we made. And I think I mentioned the first one, which was like going big or going small and so on. The second one that we had to make, in fact, multiple times, like quite 5 or 6 times since the beginning of figures, is we had the opportunity to sell the company quite a few times, right? And it's been a very tough decision for us, like for my co-founder and I, and especially 1 or 2 times where we were like, it could be a good fit. It's a lot of money, it's a lot, and so on. And it was actually, and we turned them down, right? Each time, even though it's at some point it was very tempting to say yes. And the last time we did, it made things much, but every time there was a new opportunity coming up with bigger amounts and so on, every time it became a huge issue with us. Like the first time it happened, the first serious offer we got, or the real offer with the term sheet and so on we received, I didn't sleep throughout the night, right? So I actually didn't sleep 1 minute. I was stressed out and so on. And it was always a tricky decision, but the last time we had to make that decision, since then, this is where we're like, you know what? We're on a specific journey and we're going to enjoy this journey and we don't want it to end. Yes, yes, it could be a good financial fallout and so on. Something we might never find again, especially since the market has moved since, right? Maybe it was a bad financial decision, but it's a good personal experience decision because we love what we're doing. We're super impatient of what we can do in the next few months, the next few years, and we just want to enjoy that. And since then, it actually alleviated a lot of weight off our shoulders to be like, just enjoy the ride, just enjoy this experience. Maybe the only time in our lifetime we'll know this, and I don't know.
That's very interesting. The emotional side of it is something that's underrated, isn't it? Because of these big decisions you have to make, and as you say, you've taken a big risk. You're putting a lot of energy in. You've opportunity costs. You know, you could be sitting at home doing a great, corporate career and doing all those types of stuff. That's the easy choices, right? So you bounced away from that. So the emotional roller coaster, I think, is something that we all try to need to manage. Interesting to know whether you've developed any techniques to do that, Virgil. I mean, how do you deal with these highs and lows? I think one of the things that's important to do is to obviously try and maintain some sort of steadiness throughout, because, if you're like almost like, I see a CEO of a startup as essentially like a captain of a boat, and the sea is like, bouncing around. He needs to be calm. He needs to be able to make sure the boat is still sailing, irrespective of these ups and downs. Is there a technique that you do, or is there anything that you can tell us about your own approach as to how to manage the emotional aspect?
I think for me, I wouldn't give out any advice because I think it's quite personal. And in fact, the one I'm going to give is quite common, right? I think there's two things that has helped me out a lot. The first thing is just like my routine in terms of not cutting off, regardless of workload, on sports, right? So for me, sports is a big part of my life. Riding my bike is a big part of my life, and I don't want to compromise on that. So even when I'm super busy, I'm like, this needs to happen. And in fact, it's part of sports. It's part of doing my massage once a month. It's sleeping, trying to sleep well. And maintaining that has been super helpful because for me personally, I have quite the virtuous or vicious circle between health and mind. When I start having not doing any kind of sport, not eating well, not sleeping well, I start feeling pretty terrible, right? Like I think most people, but for me, it's very present. So sticking to my routine, like even if I'm incredibly busy, I'm like, I need my sport. I need to ride my bike. I need to do this. It's very important for my mental health. And I think the first point I kind of knew, but it became more important. The second point, however, I really realized, I think the past year and a half, is mental health and is having a support around me, people I could talk to about my doubts, my stress, my fears, and all those kind of things. And it's like close friends that I've become closer since then. It's advisors, like I think there's one advisor I mentioned previously also, Nicolas, who's been a game changer for me personally, from a professional and personal perspective, helped me out through some of those tough decisions. Someone I could tell that I was feeling not confident, insecure. I actually doubted of the company, of myself at time and so on. And then it's just mental health professional. Like I see, I'm not ashamed at all of saying I see a shrink once per week, and it's a mandatory part of my daily routine. A vital part of my daily routine. So I think it's physical health, routine, sleep, and just mental health, which is, I mean, it's becoming more and more of a topic, but having a support system in place of close friends, family, and advisor and mental health professional is key, and something I think most, like 99% of people, are not doing enough.
You know what? That's actually just visualizing the amount of like support you have. It seems that you've kind of got an infrastructure of support there, which is really, really, right, powerful. Because I think you're right. Most people are wandering around without any of those components, or maybe they have one or two components. But you have the routine, your own kind of coaching. You're like getting on the bike, right? That helps. No question, by the way, folks. Physical activity, I think, really does help. Your body and mind aren't separate. The two things are working in sync. You know yourself, if you're not being physically active or your physical activity has gone down, your mood will also go down. Please do track this, folks. It is the case. we need to find ways to make that routine stick no matter how busy we are. And secondly, as you mentioned, you've got personal friends, you've got your professional advisors, and you've got professional support to give all of these inputs and all of these perspectives. I think that's a really powerful, the way in which I imagine this is almost like a professional athlete. It's not just the athlete. There's a nutritionist, there's a strength coach, there's a technique guy, there's a person who does equipment, there's a massage person. Like the entire group is gets together in order to make sure optimal performance for the athlete when there needs to be. Guess what, folks? The CEO is an athlete. Any individual is actually an athlete. You have performance that you need to maintain. And everyone needs that support. So I think we're moving towards a way in which all of this is more acceptable. But I, as you say, it's still probably a little less mainstream than it should be. But great that you have all of those things to hand, Virgil. Moving on to sort of your kind of decisions when it comes to building the team. You mentioned growing the business and building the organization was one of the things that you enjoyed to do, Virgil. Probably the most significant hire would be the first person you didn't know. The first hire you hired where maybe, yes, we didn't know this person. They came from outside. How did you assess for quality? How did you make sure that this is the right person, the right fit to what you wanted to do? You know, what was your approach to recruitment at that point?
Well, I think this is where I think my background did help into having thought about this quite all most of my career into having the right person and so on. So, meaning very early on, in fact, very early on, we wrote down with Bastien, my co-founder, once again, what would be our values, what would be assessing, how we'll be assessing people on those values and so on. So I think the very early on, we tried to spend a little bit of time thinking about this and thinking of way to evaluate this. From our first hire onward, we had that discussion and that framework and that scorecard to evaluate people on that. And then, yes, I mean, talking of scorecard, I think one key element that I brought from my previous career is being very tough on you don't hire people, you don't open roles without a scorecard, without a clear mission, without expected outcome, and so on. And that drives first of all, that validates the fact that you have a real need for the role, and then after it drives naturally the way you're going to evaluate that person throughout the interview scorecard as well. So I think very early on I had that. Well, I guess that that mindset and that experience that from the past that it needs to be very structured. Like it's not because we're a small business, because it's our first hire, second, third hire that we can go around and just have some gut feel about who we should hire, how we should hire them. It was a very structured process, I think, from the get-go.
And is the team in person or remote? How have you made that decision, Virgil?
It's actually a good point. So our team is now half remote, half is in Paris. The other half, I'd say a bit more now even, is anywhere in France or in Europe. Like we have now two people in the UK, one soon two in Germany. And one person in Spain, the rest in the rest of France. So we're running an hybrid model where people are free to work wherever they want, but they need to come back 3 days a month all together at the same time. So this is a model we've chosen to work as. It's worked quite well, even though now we have those questions that every company has, especially as a fully distributed or hybrid model. How don't you create two subcultures, one for the office people, one for the rest of the team? How do you create synergy and just life for the entire team, including those in the office and those who are not? For now, the only thing we've done, and I think we do relatively well, is the fact that we bring back, once again, the whole team 3 days per month. But something we're not doing well is the other 28 days per month doing something to maintain that company culture. So on that part, we're not doing very well.
Well, I mean, your honesty, I think, is really refreshing throughout all of this conversation, Virgil. It's a real winning quality. And I think most companies would say, though, it's an imperfect, sort of everyone's imperfectly doing it, right? Because it could be that hybrid is an inherently difficult thing to try and achieve. So it is something I don't think anybody does perfectly. It's, I think, a really ambitious idea in any case to try and bring the team together, multi-country, bring them together three times a month. I think that's a really powerful thing. And if people kind of look to join figures, for instance, they would know that this is a component of how you do it. And I think that's the key. If you have like clarity in terms of your approach, that should help at the very beginning. It's when you start changing it, and when you have people and you're trying to, you know, have an inconsistent sort of way of operating, no one is comfortable with that, because you have to then change your approach, change your behaviors and everything in order to adapt.
I think on this one, Hung, which is interesting, is the first, it's like 3 days per month. 3 days per month, we have people coming back. So one time per month, 3 days, everyone coming back together from a Wednesday morning or lunchtime to the Friday afternoon. And to your point, because I fully agree, and to bring up something maybe a bit more controversial to hear, like Elon Musk's decision and email to all of Tesla, right? It was all of Tesla employees that they have to come back working full time in the office. Like, not at all my vision, as I said, of working. I think it's a lack of trust and not entirely not my vision on remote work. But to some extent, I actually applaud someone being like very clear and transparent about where he wants to go.
Well, he was super clear. I mean, that was his second email, right? I mean, he had a two email salvo, and the second email subtitle was "to be super clear." And it was like, yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. A lot of people kind of lambaste Musk, of course. I think overall, it's interesting how HR or TA generally perceive CEOs that make these types of decisions. I remember the guy in Goldman Sachs 2 years ago, he was saying, we're going to go back to the office. Everyone piled into him and say, this is a dinosaur, etc. But at the time, you think, you know what, at least he's saying what he wants. Yeah. And then if you don't want, then you can leave. That's okay. Exactly. What is the worst thing is if you say something you don't believe in, and then you already have a plan to change it down the line when it's easier for you to do. That's cowardice. And I think even worse than cowardice is when you're incompetent, like you don't even know, and you refuse to make a decision. And everything is the next 3 months we'll do this. And then, you know, how are people meant to make decisions? It's like, come on, if you can't make a decision, no one else can make a decision. So I agree with you. I think Musk is a contrarian, obviously. I think sometimes he does this for effect also. Half the time, I think he wants to stir the pot. But at least he was super clear. Okay, let's talk about something that's close to your heart, Virgil. I'm not sure what your opinion on it, but there is a movement toward salary transparency. Now, firstly, this is as a HR person, we're saying, yeah, this is great. But if it all happens, that's you out of a business, right? So in many respects, you don't want this, but maybe you do want it. So how do you sit with salary transparency?
Yeah, it's amazing question. And so let's be super clear. I'm all in favor on salary transparency. And I'd love a world in which part of our business, because what we're building is goes beyond benchmark. But for now, we go out of business on the benchmarking because everything is public and transparent. I love this one. Yes, I think it's a business impact, but I'm all for transparency. And in fact, this is what we're doing on our own job ads as well. I'm pushing towards transparency because I think transparency will lead to reduction of inequality and unfairness in compensation. So our mission is to actually help empower companies to make fair decision and efficient decision. And I believe that transparency goes towards that. In fact, you know what? One thing we started recently is asking companies how transparent they are. Is they are not transparent at all? Transparent on their compensation policy and philosophy only. Transparent on their salary grids or transparent on their entire salaries, like individual salaries. And I hope that a few weeks down the line, we'll be able to measure, which is my gut feel, that the more transparent are the companies, the less inequality there is within their own company. Because it's something we measure in our clients, unfairness within the same role, including the gender pay gap. My gut feel is that the more transparent companies are, the less inequality and unfairness there is. So 100% in favor of pay transparency.
I would be very interested to have that data when you have it. I think most people will be also very interested to see it. I am kind of less confident in your view. And the only reason why, and by the way, I am 100% in agreement with you, but the only reason why I'm less confident in the larger statement is because I read something, I think I put it into Brain Food this week, or maybe it's going in next week, about where inequality sits most. And it turns out that it's a certain subset of companies that are the biggest employers, that pay the biggest wages, they're the ones have the biggest disparity, right? So in other words, you're looking at Facebook as an example, Meta, they hire a lot of engineers at very high salary, but they distort the rest of the market if you put them into an aggregate, because suddenly you can start saying, oh, most engineers are men. All these men are being paid 250, 500 grand a year. Therefore, the salary disparity is like, oh, massively awkward and weird because they are such a big hire. So it's almost like the big firms have a disproportionate impact. You remove them from the system and then you have another aggregate. So maybe that's another filter you could apply. But anyway, all things being equal, I totally agree. Being transparent will eliminate the individual negotiation. The individual negotiation is clear gender variance as the preferences there. Men prefer to do this much more than women. And presumably that preference is due to the fact that men believe that they can negotiate higher, I assume. So that in fact may manifest in a sort of a pay difference as a result of it. So yeah, do let me know when that money comes. And yeah, I it's interesting where the journey you're in, you know. It's like, okay, you want this world to appear, but if the world does appear, then yeah, maybe Figures loses its value. But a product like Figures basically helps companies helps that world happen, right? Because it helps companies understand, if you do go to transparent route, here are the numbers you need to go with, because I think half the time you don't want to do it because you don't know whether you're over or underpay or whatever it is. That can be a big barrier for you to go transparent.
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, you know, we are building features towards more pay transparency because we want to push our clients to share more of their data, share their market positioning, share market data when they send out an offer to a candidate, say, hey, the offer we are making, as so that you know, it's like at the 60th percentile of Figures market data. Take a look yourself. So we want to push the companies towards transparency, even though, yes, it might be counterintuitive in terms of business, because this is where this is our vision and our values to some extent. Taking a stance towards more transparency will reduce inequality.
No, I think that's fantastic. Virgil, you mentioned that you know, benchmarking was just one of the, obviously the first thing that people might know Figures for, but just you're expanding and diversifying beyond this. So what other things can Figures customers expect to see from you guys in the next 6 months, 12 months going down the road? Product development, product things that they can play with and have a look at.
So first of all, we're going to keep improving our benchmarking piece, right? So the good thing we have is we're going to improve some of the features in there to provide more value, such as market movements, following market movement more closely per role, per location, and so on, to be able to detect surges in demand or compensation for certain roles, which is something that I think will provide a ton of value to some of our clients. But going beyond benchmarking, there's two key things we have in mind, and one we're working on at the moment, is what we call the compensation review piece, right? So I've done compensation reviews in all my HR career, always been a mess, always been done with spreadsheets, manual spreadsheets, taking a huge amount of time, and we want to change that. So the overall experience of doing compensation reviews, meaning having managers, like it's done in 99% of companies, right? Managers have a budget. They decide to suggest salary increases to some people from their team. It gets validation by their manager, or the HR, or the CEO, and so on. This whole thing is done in spreadsheets for nearly every company on earth. And I think it deserves a better tooling. And also, to some extent, and that goes beyond what the product we're building, is they need, a lot of companies actually need support and methodology in doing so, right? And we don't want to be a consulting firm, right? We don't want to have an army of consultants helping companies. We want to productize and in fact generate content, high quality content, to help our clients. How do I define my compensation policy? What is the percentile? In fact, you're talking to me about a median 60th percentile. What is that? Why should I decide to position myself at the median at market, or go towards the 70th percentile, or be at median but 70th percentile for tech, and so on? How do I plan for a salary increase budget? Should I take into consideration inflation when I'm doing my salary increase budget? How do I do that? How do I define this? How do I suggest a salary increase for my employees based on performance and budget and things like that? Most of our clients, actually, for them, it's a tooling issue that I mentioned previously. Most of them do it in spreadsheet, manual spreadsheets, which is a pain, a struggle, not a great experience, and a ton of errors and mistakes are being done. but it's also a methodology issue. A lot of them are just waiting for guidance, waiting for support. And I think we can provide that in a productized, scalable way to many, many companies, because we have, as of today, 450 clients, which we're targeting 1,000 by the end of the year. And I think we can bring that kind of value to our client, which will indirectly, our belief is that if our clients have better tooling and better methodology, if we help them out well, it's going to lead to more efficient decisions, but it's going to lead to more fair decisions. So indirectly, we're going to have an impact on fairness, an impact on people directly, indirectly through the companies by helping them take fair decisions. Because yeah, some of the last, and I'll finish on that, so a lot of the unfairness that's created is not by design. It's not company being like, I want to be unfair. Or I want to have a gender pay gap in my company. I want to discriminate against women when it comes to salary negotiation. They're just unaware. They just like methodologies. They just like tooling. And we can have an impact there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, most of the times where there is inequity, it is not by deliberate strategy. There may be the odd nut case out there that decides, yes, I'm definitely going to pay these people less. But if you imagine if they had that mentality, they wouldn't recruit them anyway. So I think the pay itself is probably not a good signal. The pay inequity is not a good signal necessarily to look at the attitude at the C level. It's oftentimes a case of implementation error that manifests itself in such a way that these things occur. So if you can provide a way to get better at implementing salary reviews and salary changes and compensation changes, then all of that will manifest into more positive, more equitable outcomes downstream, which I think everyone will be very positive to hear about. At the end of the day, I fundamentally believe most of us just want a fair shot at things. We just don't want to be treated unfairly. So if your product and your kind of vision helps companies do that, then all the more power to you. One thing that's great about Figures also is that your product and your service gets better the more companies use it. So it has this natural kind of network encouragement, right? So in other words, you've got 450 customers right now. It is a better product if 1,000 companies use it, and yes, it's a better product still when 10,000 companies use it. So, I mean, I selfishly, I'm going to say you should use Figures. I think there's a way you can use it for free, isn't there? Or there's a way in which you could interact with it in some way and get some value initially without any cost, I believe. So check it out. I think it's figures.com. No, figures.hr, isn't it?
What's the, figures.hr, exactly. Figures.hr.
That's it, figures.hr. Check it out, folks. Vigil, let's finish off our conversation with a few kind of entrepreneurial tips or leadership lessons that you've kind of developed over time. And I know you're a guy that doesn't want to give advice and all the rest of it, because I think you deeply respect people's individual journeys and individual contexts. But from your own journey that you've made, what sort of advice, let's put it this way, what sort of advice would you give yourself now that you've gone through this process of being a CEO and a leader of a business? If you could teleport back 2.5 years down the road and you could say, hey, Virgil, you kind of do this. Yeah, it's a bad thing. Don't do that. Like, what kind of advice would you give that younger version of you?
Well, I think, first of all, I've made a ton of mistakes, like everyone does, right? And to some of them, I don't regret, because I think there was valuable lessons in there. I know it sounds cliche, but it's actually the case in lots of mistakes we made. I think I think it comes down to some of the things we've said, the environments and the entourage, like finding people who can help you, who've been there, who can challenge you, and in fact, who will challenge you directly. You know, one of our number one value is radical candor, right? And in fact, something that I deeply, deeply believe in before I created Figures, the power of feedback and direct, but like radical candor type of feedback, very direct, but very benevolent, like with kindness and caring behind it. Finding people with experience willing to be very direct and challenge you very early on, I think is a huge difference maker. Having people being like, you know what, why are you doing this? I'm not sure it's right, right? And I'm giving you advice. At the end of the day, you might push on with your decision, but challenging you on lots of decisions. I mean, in my case, I saw once again the point, there was a turning point since when I met, I think, Nicolas that mentioned once again, who's been an advisor of us and of me for a bit over a year now. Difference maker for us as a company, for me personally, in terms of personal growth in my role, I think it's been a huge difference maker. So you have one advice, just meet people who have been there and who are willing to challenge you on your decisions in a radical kind of way, I think is huge.
That in itself, that needs to be a strategy, doesn't it? Like a lot of times when people hear good advice, nothing ever happens because firstly, they accept the advice, they accept the logic of it and go away and say, yeah, Vijay, I totally agree. But then they don't like implement it or they don't put a strategy behind getting that thing to happen. So for instance, the entrepreneurial journey you mentioned, critical for you to be in an environment where there's lots of entrepreneurial innovative types. A lot of people hearing this conversation would agree, but then they wouldn't put themselves in a position to make that circumstance happen. So I think we can all take this advice, folks. If this thing's happening in your life you're not happy with, or in your business that you're not happy with, and it's recurring, you already probably have received the advice. You've heard it already. I'm sure you've read it already or heard it already, but you haven't put a plan to make it happen. So you've got to get yourself into that environment where this stuff is going to occur. A lot of life turnaround stuff is exactly this way. You keep it in the theory. It's in a book somewhere. It's in, you know, you read the book and you wonder why it's not working. Guess what? The words don't just magically work. You've got to then say, right, regression plan this. This is how it works. This is where I want to be. How do I get there? Oh, I need to join a entrepreneurs club or something. Or I need to maybe go to that coffee shop where I see a lot of entrepreneurs walk in, or whatever the thing you want to achieve. That's where you need to lean towards and go in towards to do. Okay, cool. So Virgil, forecasting a little bit further forward, what is the sort of, in fact, we'll talk about what's happening later today. I mean, let's do short form firstly. After the end of this conversation, what busy CEOing things have you got on the table that you have to do?
Something I can't yet talk about, so it's a bit tricky for me to answer part of that question, but... let's say still part of some stuff I can't talk about actually seriously, but some of this is just like managing a team, because I'm mostly managing, in fact, too many people at the moment, right? Which is where at that phase where I have too many people, I think, reporting to me directly, and I'm not providing them the appropriate amount of care and management I should. So I think trying to do a bit of that is one point. And point number two is a product, spending more time on the product to deliver some of the things we discussed, some of the things we haven't discussed, because there's so much more we can do. And this is a tough one for me, is to live with the frustration of to find joy into what we're doing and the value we're doing and the product we have, instead of feeling too much of the frustration of what I feel we should have ideally and I should have released. So I think working on the product is what's I think I can have an impact, and what drives me, gives me the most energy.
No, that makes perfect sense. And by the way, I think that's also one of the things that is true for the entrepreneurial journey, particularly the acceptance that you can't have everything completely finished to satisfaction. But if you you go for it and you hit 80% every day, let's say, that's probably going to accumulate over time, and that will work. So don't beat yourself up over stuff where it isn't perfectly complete. Business, like life, is generally a messy thing.
Yes.
You know, it's a messy thing. It's not a work of art. You just got to pile on through it. It's more of an artisanal experience. So that's the way it goes. Vijay, listen, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you, man. Really enjoyed your candor. Really appreciate how honest you've been in your review. By the way, no one reads anything in terms of like contracts and stuff like that. I think that's totally true. That is, by the way, is also a massive startup opportunity. By the way, someone needs to find a way to absolutely validate what this legal document means and then just put it into two sentences, because no one is actually reading this. And we are all habitually signing stuff no one reads. So someone please build that. But Vijil, thanks for appearing on Founders Focus. It's been great having you. We'll be speaking again. I think we've got a webinar series lined up. So we're going to look forward to talking a lot more about compensation, leveling, equity. All of these things are huge, important topics. So make sure we'll talk about that when those shows are set up, and make sure you join us for that. Vijil, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining Founders Focus, man.
Thanks for the invite. It was a blessing, and looking forward to our next events together. Hein?
Take care, man.
You too.
Wasn't he a great guy? I really love how refreshing Virgil was in that conversation. Virgil Rengar, by the way, of figures.hr. Okay, that's about it, folks. Thanks for watching. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Follow the channel, by the way, if you're interested in continuing to take part or listening into these interviews I'm doing with founders. Also, same channel, we're talking Brain Food Live. That's a panel and conversation that we typically have on Friday. This Friday, we're going to be talking about how to recession-proof your career. So whatever you're watching this, Crowdcast, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, if you're a recruiter and you're thinking, oh my goodness, the world might actually be taking a turn where I need to seriously start thinking about positioning in the right way in order to stay future-proofed, that is a show you need to watch. Follow me on LinkedIn if you're not already, or register, better yet, register and follow on the Crowdcast channel to watch that show. Okay, that's about it, folks. Thanks for watching.